Okay, so what I thought I would do is I thought I would go into an experiential process on this. And here's what I'm going to play with. And I don't like using surprise when I teach. That's cute. It's kind of fun, cute. But I don't think people learn as much from being surprised as they do from getting a sense of where we're going and then going there. So I want to give you a little lay of the land here so that you know what I'm going to be leading you towards, because this is not a pass-fail, do you get it, you do you not get it kind of thing. This is an invitation to experience, and quite honestly, if there's resistance to experiencing it, you're not going to experience it, then you don't get the point. So I want to kind of lay things out. I didn't honestly know how to do one thing at a time, but I figured out three ways of activating most of these soul movements. I figured out three ways where I could centralize two at a time. Okay? So it's not going to be a full-bore guided meditation because I don't know how to do that on the telephone. What I'm going to invite you to do is to simply be with yourself. You do not owe me an explanation. You do not owe me an answer. You do not owe anything to this call except to allow what I am saying to resonate in you. I also am not looking for any particular experience. There is no right answer. So I'm just going to talk for a little while and be silent and let it lay there. And then suggest some things that might have been going on. If anybody at that point wants to share, you are more than welcome, and I'll mention it. And if not, we'll go on to the next. So, number one of three is a little exercise to play with eros and or dreams. And this would be more in the daydream category, and it could even include imagination. Very hard to separate these. What I would like for you to consider is why you're here on this telephone call. It doesn't really matter whether I'm fulfilling your expectations. What I'm referring to is, what made you pick up that phone? And I invite you to go back to the impulse of reaching for the telephone. What was your longing? What did you want? What was your dream? What could be possible if the phone call worked for you? Where do you want to go where this is a stepping stone? One of many. And it was worth going out of your way to put your foot on this call and then spring off it. Where are you springing to? Where could your foot land next? be that you don't feel anything right now. There could be many reasons for that. That doesn't mean you don't have feelings. It just means you can't feel them. It's a bit of an oxymoron, but it's a reality. You do need to be able to feel feelings. So you've always got the chance of looking up the recording of this and fast-forwarding, and because it'll be in the second half of the recording, you can automatically go to part two and playing with it again. Because my question about picking up the phone this time would be the same if you got on your computer and went to the web when you were going through the browser pages, when you were looking for the link to click. What were you actually clicking for on a soul level? Why did you enlist your mind to wade through computer nonsense? Not the computer you're looking for. There's something your soul wants. That's about Eros. It has some element of dream in it. And some element of imagination. So I want to allow for the possibility that people might have questions or even want to share, even though this is a slightly awkward format, and offer that in this moment. Okay, and I'm going to go on.
Jen, I can share. Yes. It's Wendy here.
Yes.
I just, after these calls, I get clarity and insight, and things that were unconscious sort of start moving and I recognize them. So, and I particularly know with Eros and with feeling that they're areas that I wanted to understand more. Yeah. So you said there's no wrong answer, so that's fine.
And I want to honor that you could go to the movies and get that. You could go in the backyard and look at the moon. There are lots of places for clarity to come to you. This is one of them.
Yeah. Well, this stirs things up for me more than most. It stirs things up in a positive way. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay, so we're going to go on to exercise 2 of 3. And this was intended, this one is intended to focus upon imagination and dreams. So I invite you to imagine some place, either in your actual memory or in an archetype memory that you don't fully understand, based upon the plays you've seen and the books you've read and the poetry you've loved. The still water of a pool. You could do this with the ocean. At certain phases of the ocean, but I'm inviting a particular experience, and a pool is particularly useful for this. And if the pool is still, it is almost always because there is no breeze, and there is no activity. activity going on in the pool. So the first thing I'd like to invite you to notice is that you have a picture. You have an image. And I didn't dictate that image, but even if I did, it wouldn't have worked. Because you can't dictate imagination. If I said the pool must be blue, there are 1,000 shades of blue. If I said it had to be night, there are 1,000 levels of night. No matter what I said, there are variations, and those variations are being supplied by you. I invite you to notice how complete your picture is. That it is probably complete on a photographic level. Now what I'd like to invite you to consider is disturbing the pool. Now, some of you may want to simply put a finger or a hand into the pool. And some of you may gently toss a pebble in the pool. And this even works if you take a boulder and throw it in the pool. You know what happened. I want you to notice the ripples. That although they become small, it would take a very, very long time for that energy to dissipate. And no matter how violently you disrupt the pool, it still takes a very, very, very long time. And notice how much of that time is in the finishing up stages, where something is still happening even though it's almost microscopic. So as the ripples go out, they actually hit the edges on the opposite ends of the pool and come back. I'd like to use that image. And I would like you to imagine that thoughts and feelings are like dropping a stone in a cosmic pool. And just to simplify things, focus on one single thought and imagine it going out into the spirit world. And see if you can notice what it might be like if the arrival of a thought in the spirit world were like the arrival of a stone in a still pond. And notice that thought or feeling has an effect. going to invite you to notice that when I suggested you lob a thought or a feeling into the spirit world, you had an image of what the spirit world was like, and that that's no less valid than your imaginary picture of the lake or the pool. And that if you took that image of spirit world as containing grains of truth, and you looked at it and said, what do I believe about the spirit world? What is my concept about the spirit world? What is my understanding at this time in my development of the spirit world? But that little piece of imagination could give you material to work with. I'm going to give you two more images to work with. I'm going to go back to the pool. And I want you to imagine that a family arrives with six or seven kids. And the kids jump in the pool. And they're playing with the tire. And they're swinging from the tree. And the dog's in there. And the pool is just plain chaos. And how difficult it is to see subtle splashes and their effect, because there are so many. But keeping in mind that since one little stone made such an effect, that each one of these splashes, even if they seem to create chaos, each one of these splashes from the kids and the dog and the spring and the... each one of these has an effect. Now go back to your sense of the thought or feeling entering the spirit world. Prepare yourself for overwhelm. Imagine what it must be like in the spirit world with all the thoughts and feelings that come out of you in a given 24-hour period. How many thoughts and feelings that you create? And imagine them arriving in the spirit world as worlds, one after the other, second after second, multitudes in a single second, minute by minute, hour by hour. My imagination has this soap bubble machine that it keeps creating these little globes. And yet if one has meaning, they all have meaning. And my reason for taking you here is that this is why sometimes it's hard to figure things out. It's not so much that individual thoughts and feelings are terribly, terribly complicated. They may not be. But there are a lot of them. Not only coming from us, but coming from others. So if we are impacting the spirit world with our thoughts and feelings, and every other person on this planet is also putting out thoughts and feelings, it is a very, very complicated spirit world. You feel yourself tensing up because of the overwhelm. See if you can just relax and say, boy, that's overwhelm. That's a mess. No wonder I get lost sometimes. Anybody would get lost in this. I'm going to pause again before I go on. Inviting sharing. Okay, third exercise. This this is going to seem more intellectual because I'm bringing in thought. But just let it be thought. You don't have to follow it. And feelings can sometimes be very strong because they gain dynamic and they become emotions. Just let them be feelings. And this will also be provocative, so be prepared. I'm going to poke around a little bit. I want to present two sides of a process. And I want to start with a really yucky example. I want to start with maggots in a sink, in a household sink. On a feeling level, this can be visceral, this can be immediate disgust, revulsion. In this place, I want to honor those feelings and notice where they lead us. They lead us to clean it up. They lead us to find safety. Physical safety from bacteria. Our feelings can be signposts to keep us alive and healthy. Feelings can lead us to create a sense of safety and order. Going back to it, maggots in a sink. The thought process can also lead us astray. We can get so entranced with why they're there that we disregard the seriousness of the hygiene problem. So even to an ignorant person who may not be aware of the health problems of a maggot environment, our feelings can keep us safe even before consciousness and intellect and knowledge are present. Some of our instinctive reactions and feelings are appropriate and need to be honored. Now I want to take that same example and go the other way. Only this time I want to put the maggots in a jar. And on a feeling level, we again have disgust and revulsion. And we either walk away from the jar or we throw it out. Same thing as operating. Instinctive, safety, order, not a good thing, get rid of it. Now I'm going to digress here for a moment for a reason. There was a man in 1668 named Francesco Redi, and he saw maggots in a jar. And he wondered how they got there. And his thought process led him to refute one of the leading scientific principles of the Middle Ages. And that was that life springs from nothing. He overturned the entire body of scientific thinking simply by asking a question, how did they get there? In the jar was a piece of meat. The maggots had gotten there because flies laid eggs. But to the other scientists of the day, they didn't connect cause and effect. And so the maggots simply sprang from nothing. Now, while that may seem intellectual, what I wanted to point out here is that the first thought was, wow, how did that happen? Which is just as clean a thought as, ooh, bad stuff, get it out of here so my children don't get sick. More came with that. Action came with that. Thought process came with that. And the other thing I wanted to put forward here is that thoughts and feelings in and of themselves are neutral. If you're not a scientist, you don't have Francesca's thoughts. If you're not a mother, you may not clean things up and get things back in shape as quickly as somebody else, or you might do that more quickly than someone else would, worrying about your children. But there is no inherent superiority. The key is that it comes directly from inside us. So those were my attempt, for good or bad, of little exercises to play with the power of Eros in small, banal ways, which is the easiest way to show them, actually, because when they get bigger, it gets more complicated. Other factors become involved. So a 6-inch thick romantic novel has a lot of Eros in it, but it gets really, really complicated. But reaching for a telephone to call a friend also has Eros. Imagination may make you daydream so that you miss the bus, but it's one of the most powerful tools humanity has. And if dreams are messages from spirit, then we have the power to cultivate those, to work on remembering more of them, to ask in prayer for more information. Direct link to source at our disposal. So this is why I thought I would go over the area of soul movement, meaning what we already, the raw material that we have available to us at this moment, at this time. For which you do not have to ask anyone's permission. And you don't need books for this. And it is Eros and thought, it's all these soul movements that lead us to get the books, find the teachers, find the community, and puzzle out the enigmas. I'm actually looking at a closing statement here, because I'm about done.
Well, to me, what you've been talking about seems to be very helpful in clarifying the observer self.
Okay. You want to say more about that?
No.
Well, the reason I asked, Harry, is when you say clarifies the observer self, I wasn't precisely sure what you meant.
Well, when you say the observer self, you want to know what you're supposed to be observing, and you've given some indication of, I don't want to say concrete, but your lucid kind of ways of looking at what to look at with the observer self.
No, thank you. I appreciate that. makes it much more clear.
Beg your pardon?
It makes it much more clear, thank you.
Uh-huh.
So, yes, as an observer, what are you observing? And again, this is the raw material. And I don't know anybody who doesn't go through at least these five, if not another 15, that I language cannot name. Every single day. You're a fountain of raw material. And we're not talking even about the emotional reactions, justifications, negativity, lower self-movement. There's a lot more material. But that's like the family playing in the pool. It just gets so much more complicated. But what I thought would be useful is bringing it down to an elemental level. The raw materials that we are working with in our emotional, intellectual, and spiritual lives.
I think that I think what you've talked about helps being aware of a forcing element that shows up too, that you get so confused about the difficulty of everything that you start forcing for an answer. Mm-hmm. Rather than allowing it to go its own course.
And if you're not used to looking at the subtlety of the raw material, the forcing currents make more noise, and they're bigger targets. So squeaky wheel gets the grease. We may pay a lot more attention to forcing currents and emotional reactions and argument than to the original thoughts and feelings that were present.
Jan?
Yep.
This is Lila. Sorry, I tried to join actually early. I was driving back from Estes Park, and it took me 15, 20 minutes to actually get enough reception to be able to call in. Well, I called in 3-4 times before I was able to call in and stay on. So,
okay.
Just see. So, a question about what compelled you to dial in. Especially because I worked hard to get on this call. But anyhow, seriously, I guess so, just to sort of sum up my thoughts around what I've been hearing you discussing. So, I guess what it sounds like to me is whenever you feel compelled to do something, that would be an indication of a soul movement. Because to me, that's where I've been reading the stuff about the soul movements. In fact, I was just reading 206 or studying 206, and again, he's talking about the soul movements, and then I saw what the topic was, and I said, I have to be on this call, because that's the one thing that just so, I'm like, what does he mean by these soul movements, you know? I guess I hear what he's saying, but how do I feel them? So that's what I was keying in for in your conversation, was that it's, and I guess the way I heard it, that sort of when you feel compelled is when it's more an indication that there's perhaps a soul movement behind it?
Yes, but it's a different kind of compulsion than the word compulsion may give the wrong impression. Okay,
mm-hmm.
It is a compulsion. But it's a softer compulsion.
Yeah,
okay?
Yeah.
So what, it's useful for me to read again. I'm happy to do it. What I was talking about in the beginning is that a soul movement is an obscure, can be, an obscure, hidden, and yet available reaction. The question is, who's knocking on the door? It is this little knocking on the door.
Okay, so you might have a soul movement that says, I want to reach out to connect to this person, but you might have defenses that are saying, oh, that's kind of scary, don't do that.
Right.
Okay, cool.
So what we can do is we can attempt to enact a soul movement and put force and pressure on it. What this is about is being able to discern the soul movement before we decide what action that soul movement needs or wants or justifies.
Mm.
So it's like a 1-2 punch. We're defining one before we go to two. So what I'm going for here, and I appreciate the question, is compulsion has an underlying truth to it. But the compulsion may be in error. It may miss the mark. If we can find our way back to the original soul movement, we can correct the compulsion into a conscious act rather than I gotta. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's for me, this is the soul movements is the one that every time it comes up in the lectures that I'm again, am I feeling soul movements? How do I know if I'm feeling a soul?
Mm-hmm.
So I wrestle with it a lot. So
I go to a dictionary. I have an online dictionary, and sometimes it helps. I'm looking up impulse, okay? And an impulse is a sudden wish or urge that prompts an unpremeditated act or feeling. That's closer to soul movement. Premeditated act is when we've engaged our intellect or are being pushed forward by history. But underneath that, there's a starting point. And that starting point is soft and gentle. You never have a fierce soul movement. The soul movement is, it's like it latches on or is caught up by the distortions of our personality. The soul movement would never be harsh. It might have a little anxiety, but it would not be terrified.
So I guess one thing I've noticed for myself that sometimes, I think I'm getting this right, that sometimes when there's this, I don't know if you call it a soul movement, you know, this opening, this joy, that I will find reasons to get angry to shut it down.
Right.
So would that be correct? That it's, you know, so I mean, I've caught myself doing that. It's like, what am I getting all angry for? Okay.
Well, because soul movements can't be controlled.
Yeah.
Okay, so a soul movement, if you want to play with silly examples, which are fun sometimes, soul movement is like having a small child in your house that doesn't understand what to say and what not to say in front of company. I don't know if anybody else has had the experience, but I have. My kids were frightening because they just didn't seem to get what you did or did not say in front of other people. And they would simply speak according to their impulses. And I would have to clean that up.
But don't you think we have, unfortunately, better control over it? I mean, I guess that's where I feel I don't allow myself. I'm too busy controlling the whole darn thing and containing it.
And I'm saying that what I'm speaking for here is and.
Okay.
That you can have the child in you that says, I want. And you can have the adult that says, not now. Or, that's not a good choice, but I will work with you.
So are you saying there's times when soul movements aren't appropriate?
Yeah, I think that the information
is
appropriate, but it does not necessarily mean that action must be taken.
Oh, I never looked at it that way.
Okay. So what I'm trying to do here is I'm trying to disengage the 1-2 punch. I'm trying to say, can you identify the soul movement before you have decided what it means and how to enact it? Because in all honesty, your decision, your interpretation and decision could have distortion in it. And that's where we did have a soul movement. But we got in trouble because it wasn't acted upon with as much wisdom as the real soul movement deserved.
Interesting. I hadn't gotten to that level of understanding about soul movements yet. Thank you.
What about if you have an inclination and you doubt that that's the way you should go? And I think that I'm thinking in my mind a situation where quietly I didn't do anything, but I kept listening, and it repeated itself.
Until my joke would be, it repeated itself because you didn't listen.
Right.
Okay. If it's a real soul movement, of course it would come back.
Okay, that's what it was then, yeah.
That's
at least three or four times.
That's the way, one of the ways to figure out if it's a soul movement.
Because it will repeat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's a good hint.
It may also repeat if you acted it out in a way that didn't honor what its real meaning was.
Uh-huh.
That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So let me put it another way. And again, I tend to put out somewhat intellectual examples. I realize that. I'm just naming it so that if it feels intellectual to you, you're right. It is. There's a place in science that is just as religious as any other profession or any other place you can be. And in that place of sacredness in science, it's the place where true scientists try not to assume. Where scientists treat what actually happened as sacred. And I'm saying that with the deepest honoring for pure science. Where they're simply saying, stop making up a story, stop making up a theory, stop saying, aha, I get to have my name on television. Stop that. What happened? Let's just sit with that. And let's play with that for a bit so that we truly understand what happened. Before we go start plugging it into our favorite theory. To me, that is an analogy for feeling. What I'm advocating here is that we take a little bit more time to really understand our motivation on a deeper, more profound level before we go sailing off saying, that means I should marry him. Or, that means I should buy the house. Or, I got guidance to buy this stock. Did you get guidance? Or did you just get excited and then you justified something you already wanted to do? And what I'm saying is that one of the ways you can figure this out is if it doesn't work. If it works out well, maybe it was guidance, or if it wasn't, nobody cares anyway. So if it works, don't worry about it. It's probably not an important spiritual place for you to be working right now, so it doesn't create problems. Problems are signposts. If you don't find a problem, go work someplace else. But where there are problems, where there are issues, where you are unhappy, where things aren't working out, see if you can go down to a very base level. What was my original impulse? What was I thinking in that first moment? Let me go back to that dream and try to remember what I actually remembered instead of the story I told 10 minutes later. By that, I'm inviting us to go like scientists, go down to the pure facts, to the pure experiments. I'm inviting us to go back down and find the truth of the soul movement. And then to notice what we add to it, where we go with it, what we construct from it. And that's why a true soul movement would not be a compulsion until and unless something important was at stake, and then it might. If you have starved yourself for love your entire life, then the moment Eros hits, it might create the world's biggest bushfire. I'm arguing that the bushfire itself is a little more than the original soul movement, but the soul movement at that point may have some explosive energy. So it's possible that a soul movement needs to kick hard to get born. But that would only be because it had been repressed the last 1,000 times it had attempted to express itself. So imagine your soul trying to come forward and being pushed back and pushed back and pushed back and ignored. It might exert some force. My argument is that once it was recognized, once it got free, it is not attached to a solution. It is not attached to how it must manifest. That is our intellect. That is our history. That is our social structure. The soul movement wants us to grow, not succeed. There's a difference. The soul movement wants us to transform, not become. The soul movement wants us to have freedom, not to do any particular thing, but to have freedom of choice. And true freedom of choice allows for exploration and experimentation. And it is the softness of the movement that can indicate to you whether you are dealing with a soul movement or an emotional reaction. Does that make sense? I don't even know who I was talking to at that point. So that's why this is so soft and warm and fuzzy and hard to identify. Because it's soft and warm and fuzzy and hard to identify. I use biology a lot because, number one, the guide gives me permission. The guide says that everything we deal with on the planet is a manifestation of spirit. So no matter what you look at, what you care about, what example you give, there is some truth in every single thing on the planet, including our bodies, our minds, our psychology, and our spirituality. So when I pick on a piece of biology, it's very intimate to me. It's my body. The spleen, I'm sure that many of you have heard periodically that somebody was injured and their spleen was removed. And it's such a common phrase. You never hear the spleen was repaired. But you do hear the spleen was removed. Well, part of you might be thinking, if it's that unimportant, why do we have one in the first place? And the technical reality of the spleen is that it is a filter. And it is such a fragile organ that you cannot suture it. So if you rupture the spleen, they can't sew it back together. It is simply an organ, like a little flower inside you, that once you step on the flower, it's over. Take it out. You'll lose that filtering capacity, but most of us can live without that filter. That's almost a good analogy for soul movements. And by that I mean, you can step on them. And that particular movement may go away. Another will come back to take its place, but that one may be gone. And you may not be able to resurrect it. Let's use Eros as an example. If you have eros for someone, if you just plain fall in love, and you offer yourself to them, you walk up and say hi, and they turn to you and basically give you the signal that you disgust them. I want you to imagine for a moment what happens to your eros. That may never come back. Whatever that was about, that may be over in terms of that person. You may never feel that way about that person again. That doesn't mean you won't feel eros, but not for that person. So eros can be wiped out in a particular instance, but you won't get rid of eros in your soul. It's a way the soul moves, and the soul's not going to give up how it moves just because you got turned down. But it will retract. It will stop. But if we make up a story about that, we could bring hatred into place. We could, the eros could curl up and hatred could flood in. That's so-and-so. How, I mean, you can hear the stories. Oh, there's no end to the stories. But that may all be due to wounded pride and overprotection of the eros. It could be due to all kinds of things, but it has nothing to do with eros. Eros simply turned up. It shut down. That's the distinction I'm trying to draw here. Eros doesn't hate. Hate is not the opposite of eros. Eros does not love. Love is in addition to eros. And you can't manufacture eros. If you don't have it for someone, whatever you create to substitute for it is just phony. It may be polite. It may even be kind. But you do not manufacture eros. For the same reason, you do not manufacture true dreams. So if someone asks you, what did you dream, and a story comes to your lips, you can dream up a story about it. Pardon the phrase. You can dream up a story about a dream. I apologize for that. That wasn't intentional. You can invent a dream just to get somebody off your back conversationally. But that doesn't mean that that was the dream.
It's imagination, though, huh?
It takes some imagination, yes. But the dream itself either is or it isn't. And if it doesn't make sense, making it make sense doesn't augment the dream. You can't augment a dream. You can try to understand it for what it is. So if you go further and further, you can see where a simple thought may or may not fit a situation in terms of what I wanted to feel or what I wanted to think. But it may be true for you. I've mentioned this before. You can cry at funeral. I mean, you can laugh at funerals and cry at weddings. That's a personal thing. And in some situations, contradictory feelings are accepted. And in some situations, contradictory feelings are not accepted, and we have to hide them in order to be socially accepted. What this work is about is knowing when you fake it, doing it when you have to, but being fully conscious of what your actual feelings are, what your actual thoughts are, and not letting a social mask, which may be necessary under specific conditions, or you may feel it's necessary, to color your thoughts or feelings or your soul movements, your eros, to the point where you can't recognize it anymore. and you now misinterpret what happened. Does that make sense? So I'm going to read a... Oh, I thought that was for me. I'm going to read a closing quote from a lecture that I'm actually going to do a teleconference on that seems to fit here. This is from lecture 201, which is Demagnetizing Negative Force Fields. And the prayer that the guide puts forward in this lecture fits this circumstance. And then he goes on to explain it a little bit. So the guide suggests the following prayer. I pray for the power, the belief, the faith, and the volition to be totally committed to living my life in a good, in a deeply feeling, in an honest way. I'll read that again. I pray for the power, the belief, the faith, and the volition to be totally committed to living my life in a good, in a deeply feeling, in an honest way. And here's the guide's explanation of that prayer. Even if some part of you still resists while you say these words, my friends, if your innermost will pronounces these words strongly and decisively, not covering up and denying the negative will, but meeting it head on, a new power is created by the force of the thought, the intent. Only too often you wait for the change to take place without your deciding for a new thought process about the issue in question. It is the thought that must change first. In the thought lies the intent. This intent can then seep deeper and deeper into the still resisting layers of your consciousness. So in that paragraph, the guide might be suggesting that intention is also a soul movement. That intention actually underlies thought. And that thought is an expression of a deeper intention. And what the guide is saying is that you can use thought to strengthen and formulate intention. You don't have to wait for intention to simply burst forward. You can use thought to strengthen it, to give it structure, to give it support. So in this way, all these things are interrelational. Thoughts and feelings can support eros. Eros can support thoughts and feelings. No one thing has to stand on its own. And that ultimately what we're talking about is the soul itself. That's what differentiates the work that I do from therapy or psychology or these other things. My work is with the soul. There was a question asked at the beginning about the quote from 44 on Eros about how finding the other as new. That's not the correct quote, but that's what I wrote down in my notes. So, giving that I'm paraphrasing terribly, this is what the guide is talking about. At some other point in the lecture, the guide says, there is nothing more exciting than seeing another soul. There is nothing more exciting than watching the manifestation of another being. How could you not be entranced? I'm paraphrasing. How could you not be entranced? How could you not be delighted? So why are we not delighted? Because that soul is not revealing itself to us. And we are not able to see it on our own. So faced with a brick wall, we lose interest. But that brick wall may have been constructed by us. It may have been constructed by them, and it may be a co-creation. Because neither one of us wants to actually meet each other. And the only way to know who built that wall, it's almost as if you have to sense into your muscle movements. Did you put those bricks up? Do you resist taking those bricks down? Then maybe, just maybe, there's some truth. That it's not their wall, but at least in part, yours. So I thought we were going to end 20 minutes early, but we didn't. So it is now 7:02 here. And I would like to thank all of you for joining me.
That was a fast 2 hours.
That's good. All right. So thank you very much for being here. This will be mounted on the website by tomorrow because I'm a fanatic and I always do it tonight. Again, thank you for being present. Much, much more fun to talk to all of you than for me to hum by myself.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jen.
Thanks, Jen. It was great.
Have a wonderful day. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.